And, you know, I heard from our executive director of music talent again today. In fact, I've talked to him a couple of times about some upcoming guests. And tonight is no exception. Glenn Rivera has arranged for John Hedges to join us this evening. And I'm thrilled that he has done that. Glenn is certainly an asset to Strictly Confidential, and we certainly appreciate all of his efforts. Now, John Hedges, actually many people consider John to be San Francisco's first pioneer disco DJ with a following. Now, John started way back in the early days at the Mineshaft on Market Street, then moved on to the City Disco, and he was named by the local press, by the way, Johnny Disco. That was his nickname the press picked out for him. Billboard magazine also awarded him a Best DJ Award. John Hedges also went on to form the DJ pool in the Bay Area called the Bay Area Disco DJ Association. And he was called into the studio by Fantasy Records and remixed huge hits from Sylvester like Can't Stop Dancing and Don't Stop and many others. And after that, John started producing for a long list of recording artists, many of which have I played when I was DJing back in the 80s. John is the former owner of Megatone Records, and I tell you, if I had a dollar for every hour I have watched a Megatone label going round and round on one of my turntables, I would indeed be a wealthy man. Megatone Records is known for recording only the best of the best, and certainly got a lot of play in the clubs that I worked. Recorded artists like Sylvester and Patrick Cowley, Paul Parker. Oh, the list is extensive. There's no possible way to name them on. So without any further ado, let's bring Johnny Disco, John Hedges, onto the show. John, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Hi. How you doing, Peter?
Hi there. Good evening to you, sir. John, can you hear me okay?
I can, which is a little louder, but I think I can hear you. It's like I'm living in Palm Springs now. It's 116.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Hola.
And I assume that you're
air conditioner running, and it's kind of noisy, but I can hear you just fine. So hello to all your listeners.
Great. Well, the volume changes.
You're in Florida, right?
I am in Florida, yes. And,
okay,
and if the volume changes during the show, you just let us know, and the studio can make adjustments for you or bring up your levels. And they have lots of knobs and dials there. They can fix it right up. And I, too, yes, I'm in North Florida, and I am currently sitting very near air conditioner with extra fans in the room. And
yeah.
I have noise suppression to help reduce the hiss of the background when I'm silent. But whenever I speak, you can hear the air conditioners and the whole thing going on in the background. Boy, I tell you, it's a hot summer, isn't it?
It sure is, sure is, sure is. But it's a dry heat, they tell me here. You guys have the humidity.
Yeah. John, I was delighted when Glenn indicated that you were willing to be on the show. And, John, there's not a whole lot of information about you as I look for information on the site. Now, the listeners to this show are accustomed to getting to know people and about their backgrounds and their interests and how they got started. So since I know none of those details and neither do the listeners, perhaps we should start there. John, where are you from?
I'm originally born in Cleveland, Ohio, and I live in a small town called Elyria, Ohio. And that's kind of where I got into the music business, kind of like music right off the bat. Built my own little pirate radio station in my garage, playing records and turntables, and a wannabe DJ. And started booking rock bands in Cleveland, the local rock bands and all that stuff. And did that for many years, and then went to a gay bar for the first time. I wasn't out of the closet quote yet. And in fact, they hired my best band, and I went into this place, and I just loved it. You know, and they had a disco DJ and all that. Not that they didn't even call it disco back then. And I said, boy, I could sure like it doing that, you know. And I soon moved, I think, in 1971 to San Francisco. And I took my business with me, my band booking business. But in San Francisco, there's so much talent. All the bands are playing for basically for free. And my agency could not make any money. And so I got a gig at a local place called the Mine Shaft. I think you just mentioned that. Started DJing there. And went on to this place called the Cabaret, which turned into the City Disco, which was the super disco in San Francisco at the time. And this is just when the disco era was kicking in. And I got Sylvester's producer's main producer, the person with Fantasy, Audrey Fuqua, happened to be at the club one night and came up, and that they wanted to hire DJs to do mixing for them at Fantasy Records in Berkeley. And that's kind of how I got into that, into the studio work. And then, of course, you learn a lot when you're mixing in there and learning the equipment. I go, well, I could do what he's doing. And start writing songs, blah, blah, blah.
I can't resist going back to the pirate FM radio station. That shows a lot of moxie. And if this was before you began DJing, you were probably a teenager when you did that.
Yes, yes, I was 16, 17, 18. I had it in the garage. My parents didn't have a clue. The garage was not used. I had like a little studio, my little, you know, my stereos and all that stuff. And all my friends would hang on. This was in the 60s, you know, this is Drug USA and all that. Everybody hung out at my place with the light shows and all that stuff, and we hooked up the station. Unfortunately, I did get busted about a year later. Ego got in the way because the local press wanted to do a story on me, and it got me, and the FCC came over to the house and warned my parents it would be $100 an hour that I was on the air as a fine, and Dad took that tower right down. Didn't even know I had the tower on the roof. It looked like a regular antenna.
That's amazing. So they actually could not find you until the report in the newspaper,
right.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was a small town, well, so FM. You know.
Yeah.
It's called
John,
that
shows a lot of technical expertise also. Were you always a hands-on sort of an electronics guru as you were growing up?
I'm a nerd. A total nerd.
That's amazing. What sort of music did you play on the, you said you played your dance music, but it had to be your pre-club days, so your dance music had to have been a different influence. What was that like?
It was mostly all the bubblegum stuff. That's probably where I got the hit gene, you know, where you know what a hit is, playing all the bubblegum stuff, all the early 45 stuff, you know, I was just watching that thing on the Ramones, and that's later, but they said they were inspired by the MC5. I remember playing that, and the Doors, and the Beatles, and all that stuff back in those days.
I see. Did you also speak on the radio? Did you announce the track?
Oh yeah.
And were you famous in your high school? You were in high school, Ed. Were you pretty much a famous guy for the radio station?
Yeah.
And that's a hoot. So I take it you probably got one of those little FM transmitter kits and hooked the linear to it. How did you pull it off?
And I had even a nerdier friend that knew how to build those things, you know, and we broadcast all over the little county area there, you know, at night, you know, 6 to 7. I even ripped off, you don't mind if I go on about this for an idea.
We would love for you to go. We like to know. We want to know everything.
I know, because you're in radio, so this is a good one. I even ripped off, this is when FM was just coming out, and so I was broadcasting on FM, and there used to be an NBC station on FM, and they would have a 5-second pause before they go for the news on the hour. So I had that, and I just ripped that news, you know, I'm kind of now the news on WHY. I do that whole thing, jingles. And that's how I got to know all the bands. That's how I got into the bands, because they all were coming around and wanted me to play their stuff, you know, on the pirate station way back then, you know.
So you were playing unpublished material from the bands directly? Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That certainly lays a very firm background for being a record producer and a DJ. I'm beginning to catch on. How did you find your way into the gay club? Was the legal age there 21, or did you go earlier? Or?
I think I was definitely 21. I think it was still 18 back then. And they called this club in Cleveland and said it was a gay bar, and they were giggling in the background. I thought, well, gay happy, you know. Fine, we'll play there. And they heard of my band called Flight at the time, and it was the big top popular band in Cleveland. I go, sure, we'll do it. And they paid the big bucks and all that. And a little side note to that, so I take the band in there, and I'm just overwhelmed because I am starting to think, getting the feelings, you know. And I always thought all the gay people were the drag queens or the dirty guy in the window doing this thing, you know. And I went in there and all these gorgeous guys there, you know. I go, And that's where I met my my other half, my lover Jerry, who I'm still with for 37 years. And we met there at this club, Dante's Inferno in Cleveland, Ohio. And if somebody's from Cleveland, they might know it. And the band that I booked in there happened to be all his friends, and he was still in the closet. And he was there, and kind of invaded his territory. It was love at first sight, obviously, 37 years we're still together. But, yes, that was my kickoff.
Well, you referred to flight. You said my band. Now, were you did you actually have an instrument? Were you a singer, or were you promoting the band?
I was. I had a booking agency called J&J Attractions, and we had about 30 bands and booked all over Ohio and West Virginia. Because I talked to your producers in West Virginia and Michigan and stuff like that, you know. And that was a big time in the 60s when all the bands are gone. Then moved on up to bigger concerts like Yes, you know, the group Yes and all that, did concerts. And that's when I started coming out and I got out of town, as it were.
Wow. Well, John, John, you were born to do this. I can't imagine a more thorough education.
Yeah.
Certainly. That's an amazing story.
You're saying there's not a lot of me out there, you know. I have to admit, I Google myself too. When I Google myself with an artist like John Sylvester, then stuff comes up, or John Hedges and Lisa, then other stuff comes up. But if I just do myself, it doesn't seem to come up. But whatever.
Well, hopefully we can change that.
Pardon?
John, what prompted you? You moved from Ohio with your partner to San Francisco. What prompted that move?
I was just coming out in Cleveland at the time was not a place. And my lover had a friend in San Francisco, and they were saying, you know, it's just free love, you know, and that was in the 60s, late 71. So I came at the tail end, but you know, it was sex and love, you know, and all that, and the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. And we said, well, let's just try, you know. And, I had no possessions or nothing at that time, and we were free birds. And we literally drove across the country and got to San Francisco, and within a few days got an apartment and just stayed there. I just moved down to Palm Springs in November, been there all that time.
Well, John, how did you – you said you began playing at a – I think the first club was the Mine Shaft. Were you made aware of the Mine Shaft back in Ohio that you should look it up because of the DJing? Or how did that work? How did you get involved with the Mine Shaft?
No, what happened was it was in my neighborhood, the little place. It was the local little discotheque. I went there and I saw they had a little DJ thing, which they had in Cleveland, but he was like behind the curtain kind of thing. I met the owner, and I said, you know, I could really do this if you ever need somebody. And it was really in the early days. I was really literally one of the first guys to do this in San Francisco. And he gave me the job, and I think I was there 5-6 years at the first place. It was, you know, the neighborhood, right to Castro, you know, and playing two turntables without pitch controls back in those days, 45. So thrilled to get a record. I remember that song, Get Dancing, by Monty Rock III?
Well, that's an oldie. I do.
Anyways, we were thrilled because it had part A and part B. And that's when you got into the mixing. You know, get two copies of the 45 and mix the long version. That was kind of fun.
Back in those days.
Go ahead.
I was thinking that back in those days, I don't think there are some 45 RPMs that did have the instrumental on one side, but not very many.
No, not very many at all. No. So that's pretty much what we did is 45, and then kind of things rapidly started to move where the record companies were going, oh, my God, we're selling records without radio play, you know. People would bring us in records, and we'd play them, you know. And then there was a small group of people, and you would talk to people in L.A. and New York. There was a small family. We'd all share this, you know. There was little, like, monthly newsletters with songs when it first started, before even Billboard was doing anything. And within a couple years when I started, that's when the 12-inch record came. And that was the big thing, to have the long version. I think it was Fly, Robin Fly, of all things.
Yeah, it's
long. Right. Midland Records. I remember, like you said, you see the Megatone records spinning around you. I could still see those records.
I can too. Visually, I can see it perfectly clearly. It almost puts me back in the exact spot standing in front of the turntables. Well, if you're doing 45 RPMs before pitch controls, how, in fact, were you able to mix? What technique did you use? How do you, in other words, here's the deal. I DJed in the 80s. Now, we had pitch controls and all the, and the mixers. Well, how did you guys do it?
I literally almost faded in, but it wasn't different. There wasn't that many, though. You know, the pitch control came in pretty rapidly, you know. I remember going to New York and the 12 West, Jim Burgess, big-time DJ. And do you interview other DJs and stuff? Like, have you ever heard of Jim Burgess?
Well, yes, I know Jim Burgess because I have a number of his remixes, and you're right, he's an absolutely stunning DJ. He's not been on the show, but yes, we've had a number of DJs that have been on the show, certainly.
Yeah, he'd be a great guest. But anyways, he inspired me tremendously. I went to this place called 12 West, and Grace Jones was just coming out with I Need a Man, and I'm at 12 West, and it's like they call it the floating dance floor, or, you know, when the bigger the crowd gets, that's the dance floor, you know, and out of the blue, I hear him mixing out of a song and into I Need a Man. And here comes Grace Jones out of the floor. You know, there's a trap door. She's coming up singing I Need a Man. But I'm going, oh, my God, he lined up those beats, you know, and it went on forever. And so, you know, that's like wildfire, you know. You had to do that.
Well, this was on a trip that you and your partner Jerry took back to New York?
Me. I would go because I just wanted to see what was going on in the New York thing, because they were a big thing before San Francisco really hit it with the Megatone Records and Moby Dick and some of the other labels and stuff, you know. And Fantasy, Dance Disco Heat, when I worked there, that was a 12-inch. Yeah, that was a 12-inch, too. And I don't know where I was going with it. Go ahead.
Well, I was wondering about Jerry, actually. How does Jerry, does Jerry have a love of music? Does he like to mix also?
Yes, that's the one thing we had in common. Yes, he loves the dance music thing. In fact, he loves it more. He listens to it 24/7 almost, still to this day. It's on right now in the living room. He listens to it. I swear to God. And so it's good because I can keep up on what's going on because I'm working here locally now. And it's kind of that was his love of music, and he was in the real estate, you know, real estate business, mortgage banking, and all that stuff. But it was great perk, so I stayed in there, and I really enjoyed it. So we got to go to all the hotshot places, and you know, when you're in the business, here's
well, you know, John, that's really a wonderful advantage because there is so much music and so much was going on back in those days, and even today, that it almost takes two people to keep track of any of it.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like you said with the Bay Area BATA, I call it the Bay Area Disco DJ Association. That was a wonderful thing, which I started because just to get all of us together to know what everybody else was doing, you know, they got organized, you know, and then the record labels could drop ship all these records for all the DJs, you know, without radio plates to make hits, you know, and it was sensational.
John, where were you playing when you were discovered by the fellow Harvey, and am I pronouncing it correctly, Fuqua?
Harvey Fuqua. He used to be with Motown Records. I was playing at the City Discotheque on Montgomery and Broadway in downtown San Francisco.
I see. And he was a customer who used to come in to listen to you. He approached you to offer you a job.
Yeah, we also had downstairs a cabaret situation, and I think Sylvester, I cannot remember this, people ask me this, I cannot remember, and of course Sylvester is not around, but I think Sylvester was doing a cabaret show before he was doing the disco thing, and just did that Marty Reel thing, and Dance Disco Heat, and I think they just came upstairs, they, you know, were all about the thing, about the disco, you know. And I just had a lot of press in the paper and all this stuff, you know, with being the DJ. We were superstars back in those days.
And you had the trademark symbol of a hat. I think you wore a cowboy hat when you were called Johnny Disco. That's pretty cool. I'm looking at some pictures of that. How cool is that? And that was back in the day, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's the Wild West, man. Someone gave me that hat, and it just stuck. You know, and then you get a, you know, it's just like anything in show business, and you just stick with it, your glasses or your hat. And so that was a little gimmick. Later, that went away.
Well, so, John, was it Harvey who introduced you to Sylvester? Apparently, he called you in to do some remixing for Sylvester. Is that how you met Sylvester?
Actually, I met Sylvester. Actually, it goes on a little further. What happened was the light man downstairs was Patrick Colley.
Wow.
Yeah, Megatron Man and all that. He did some synthesized work on You Make Me Feel Mighty Real. That's where the connection came in. Yeah, and I met my partner, Marty Blechman, who we did a lot of mixes together, who was my roommate from my hometown in Leoria, Ohio. And he moved out a couple years later, and we got in our mixing business thing. And that's where we met Sylvester in the studio with the Two Tones.
I see. The Weather Girls. John, were you reel to reel then? Were you using razor blades and tape to do these?
Absolutely. Big 10-inch reel to reels, razor blades, splice. Long time. Nothing like today, copy paste, you know.
Yeah, copy paste. Our friend Glenn, of course, has taken some time to edit down some of these extended 12-inch dance tracks to make it more friendly for us to use in the show and leave more time for us to talk. So I want to ask about Don't Stop. Now, is Don't Stop the version that we're going to hear from Megatone? Was this edited on reel to reel and tape and splicing and hours of?
Yes, I was in the studio mixing it, but had an engineer at the time because it was called the Automat, where you weren't allowed to touch anything. You would tell them, you know, they had a counter, cut here, you know, go to the bridge, go to the chorus, go to all that, or drop out.
Wow.
They would let us touch the controls. You know,
imagine how frustrating that would be for you, especially because of a technical beginning. It had to just make you want to scream.
Well, you have to understand that the Automat, that place, was major, big-time rock star. You know, Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane. Everything was so organized. I mean, they hated us because they didn't hate us, but it was a thing going on back then. When disco came in, we were putting bands out of work to beat all these discos because the bands were used to be the ones that play and take a 20-minute break and all this. So there was this tension always going on in these studios. Except at Fantasy, because Fantasy, Creedence Clearwater Revival was there and all that, but they wanted to get into dancing, so there was a lot of good things. So if you had to go to another studio, you had to play by their rules, or forget it. But Don't Stop, that was Ken Kesey, I believe, edited. I can't remember. Getting kind of fadey after all these years.
Yeah.
But I remember coming in his jewelry and diamonds, and a bag of diamonds. She's going, look what I have. Jesus, girl. He was the best person, though. He was the funniest, nicest guy you ever want to meet.
Yeah. It has to be. So then Don't Stop was one of the early ones that you were involved with Sylvester.
I produced it. I co-produced it with Chip Woodward. And later he wanted to change it to associate producer, you know, ego, so I went for it because I'm in the business. I worked for several labels at the time. But so we did that, and Don't Stop with the Two Tons on that, and they're doing that opera thing in the middle, and with the break, it's sensational. I could see it like it's yesterday. I remember them doing the Two Tons coming in for backup, so my mom was in town. And, this time we were laying the tracks at Fantasy, and the Two Tons came in to do their backups, and they're big girls. I don't think they mind me telling this story, but while they're we're waiting and in between takes, they have big turkey legs in their hands. That's
oh my God.
That big. I can just see it right now. My mom's going, "Oh my God."
that's a funny story, and I have to share with you. Pamela Stanley was on a week ago, and she was talking about Two Tons of Fun, or the Weather Girls one. I'm so sorry, I can't remember which, but she said that they used to show up with a bucket of chicken.
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
Oh,
my. Pamela Stanley. I love her. She's down your way, isn't she? In Florida.
Pamela. She was for a long time. Her son went to college here. In fact, her son went to college at Florida State University. But when she was actually on the show, she was in Delaware. But I'm not sure if she was on a traveling tour. I'm just not sure where she at. But I think it might be Florida. She may just be on a traveling tour.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart. Really talented too. I hear from her occasionally on the email. You know. But and a couple, one of my best friends, Shan Carr, a local comedian on the West Coast here, they travel and do shows together on some of those ships or something, Atlantis or one.
Yeah, yeah. She says she has a great time doing that. And again, our friend Glenn. Yes, he's definitely our Glenn. And I would hate to lose him. Our friend Glenn Rivera was responsible for setting up Pamela Stanley, and we thank him for that. John, back in the day, disco, of course. Was cross-platform, if you will. It was played. There were huge straight discos, and there were of course the huge gay discos. And I never actually worked in a straight disco as a DJ. Although some of the gay DJs I knew when I was DJing did, you know, various nights in the week. So I really don't know what crossed over and what didn't. And the reason I bring this up is because in our listeners we have a large number of straight listeners who are actually progressive people who support us, but we also have an LGBT audience. So I'm wondering, did Don't Stop cross over into the straight clubs? What was the deal?
No. I would say almost all my songs did not cross over because I was the hardcore, high energy. When you play some of these, which you probably have anyways, they're all high energy, 132 beats per minute. In hindsight, if I would have looked back, but that's the kind of music I really enjoy, I would have slowed the beat down 120, 124 beats and made something more funky to cross over. You know, that's what we were trying to do with Sylvester before he died. It was, we got him on Warner Brothers, and to slow the beat down. He did get a Someone Like You, they're starting to cross over. But I worked in a straight club, too, for 2 years, and it's really different, and it's the whole energy thing. It's not that they don't have the energy, but the tempo of the music is different in a, quote, straight bar. You know, it's ladies' night and stuff like that, chic and stuff like that, you know, instead of the 132 beats per minute high-energy stuff. And I still think on the gay club they play that, you know. In fact, it's even faster now, you know. Go ahead.
I have to say, I was one of the DJs that would start around 130, and by the time it was over, I was at 144 or so. You know,
what was that, 144 or something, you know?
Yeah, and then there was the Cerrone track, Trippin' on the Moon, that was around 144. It's wonderful stuff.
Yeah.
Wonderful stuff. And I wonder why that is, that in the gay clubs that we seem to just thrive on the high energy, go fast stuff. We really do. It's like our nectar. Do you have an explanation for that?
I discuss this with people, and one reason is drugs in the clubs. My dog's slamming out the door. He's throwing his body to come in. Excuse me, come on in. I got a little beagle.
Cool.
But the other thing is, we would not dance arm in arm or couples and do the holding hands and flipping around stuff. We would dance jumping up and down. And we would get so packed and close, that's the only way you could keep the crowd happy, was to keep them moving up and down because they couldn't sway back and forth. So just picture this now, when you play some of those slower songs, you're able to move your body more. On a higher tempo and a packed house, you've got to have that thing pumping.
You
noticed that.
Yeah, I hadn't put it together, in my mind. But, yes, now that I hear you say it, I completely get it. It's like, yeah, well, duh, but I had never put that together. That's an interesting observation.
Yeah, and I can't somebody told me, somebody goes, I would have said this thing, and goes, that's it. And you start out slow. Are we boring people with this technical stuff? I don't know.
Oh, no, we have all sorts of listeners. We have a very very eclectic and very bright audience. So let's go for it, anywhere you want to go.
No, I was just saying, when you'd start the evening, you'd start a little slower to be. But, boy, you know, by 10:30, you're cooking. You know, you're moving on up to the big midnight, you know, and all that. So you played on the East Coast?
Oh, well, Actually, when I was DJing, I was in Portland, Oregon, and I DJed there from the early 80s, about 81 or so, into the about 7 or 8 years there in Portland, Oregon.
Where?
Now, I did, I played at the zoo, a place called the Family Zoo, and I played at Ray's Ordinary on Sunday mornings, and I played at a place called the Elsewhere, and I played at Sissy's, and I was a video DJ at some place called, I can't remember the name, it's been a number.
I know those names, yeah. Cool.
You were in Portland, I'll be darned.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, when you own a record company, you have to go everywhere. And I went up there several times, in Seattle, of course, in Los Angeles, and you name it, every place I've been begging the DJs to play my records. You know?
Oh, I don't think so. People couldn't get enough of the Megatone label. You had everybody.
You still have to work it. You never take anything for granted.
Sylvester, what a wonderful artist.
Oh, yeah. Now, Sylvester, I could walk right in with a single. It'd go on immediately.
Yeah, he was a star.
He was the star of our company and the biggest star we had. Paul Parker, too, was right up there.
Oh, yeah. Paul Parker, remarkable also. We were fortunate enough to have Paul on the show a while back. Again, due to the efforts of Glenn Rivera, he could not do the music shows without him.
That's right. I ran into both of them at the bar that I work at now, the club, Mixie's. Mixie's Boy Bar. And I ran into Paul and...
Are you DJing at a club now?
Yes, just not a full-time regular schedule, mostly major events, you know, the holidays and gay pride and white party and all that. It's called Mixie's Boy Bar. It's right on the main drag in Palm Springs. First time there's been a gay bar on the main drag. There's a statue of Sonny Bono right across the street.
That's a great landmark.
He used to be the mayor of Palm Springs.
Yeah. Well, before I'd love to run this track, Don't Stop, for the listeners, and many of them will not have heard it before. Before we run it, tell us a little bit about Sylvester and the first time you met him and any stories you'd like to share with them so they'll get a feel for who Sylvester is. Many don't know.
I kind of, just meet him in the studio. He was he was a jokester in the studio and friendly, and he was very curious of what we thought we could do with his stuff. You know, he was very into that, you know, and paying lots of attention to us playing the games. I remember him showing me how to, my voice, I have a lot of reverb on it because he's got the high pitch thing and all that, and showing how to do it actually on the board and all that. But he let us, he would leave and we'd just give it to us, you know. That's the kind of person he was. And I only had one complaint. And it was a stupid thing, and Marty Blackman and I both did it by mistake. We were rushed. The song Can't Stop Dancing, which is not on that album. That's on the Live at the Opera House album. Can't Stop Dancing, the whole thing, it's a great mix, except when we left and mastered the thing, or took the tape out, somebody clicked the switch and all the echo effects went off. So when you listen to it, it's all dry. And we didn't know. They took the case, they ran it, mastered it, and it pressed it. It was too late. And he was really pissed off at that. And I don't blame him. I'm very embarrassed about that. And there was nothing we could do. We begged the record company to pull it back, and they wouldn't. And it was just a glitch in the studio. We shouldn't have been rushed. There was another act coming in, a rock band. They had it set up, and boom, boom, boom. So I learned a valuable lesson then. Never do I rush. I don't care. You know, get it right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Sylvester, go ahead. I was going to say something. Go ahead.
No, well, there's a slight delay when the internet is it's great for data, but the human voice, there's always this little weird little lag thing going. So, you know, don't worry about it. It's just part of the technology. But I was just going to say that I'm going to run Don't Stop for the listeners. But I wanted to tell you something else about one of the tracks that Glenn sent up. Now, as I told you, I was DJing in the 80s, and there's a track that Glenn edited for the show tonight called Seclusion, by Sean Benson. Now, I have to tell you, I have been listening to that track over and over and over again for most of the day because somehow it either came out after I stopped playing or I have some vague memory of it that I heard it once and I always wondered what it was. But in any case, that is a fabulous song. Who is this guy? What is his name?
Sean Benson. Right. Sean Benson, that's his name, and he used to live in San Francisco, and he would hang out this club called the Trocadero Transfer. This is the big super place when disco was really cooking. That was the hot spot. And he was the dancer out there, always with the shirt off. He just sent you the, you don't have the cover, obviously, but very good-looking black guy. And another DJ who worked next door to the place when I was working in the Castro, Mark, and God, I can't think of Mark's last name now. Phew. Dude, I'm just fading on these guys. Anyways, he was a fan of myself and Barry Blum, my partner, which I did a lot of music with, Barry Blum. And by the way, I wanted to get him on the show with us, but he's in Mexico. He just called. I said they're doing a lot of things on our songs, and it'd be nice if he'd been on. He would have loved that. He's straight.
Sure.
That's my straight partner.
Yeah.
He's the genius behind the kind of the Patrick Colley guy playing all the instruments and all that stuff, you know. And but anyway, so Seclusion. So we got together and with Barry Blum and I, and this guy Mark wrote the song Seclusion. And there was a record company. You remember TSR Records?
Sure, Red.
Yeah.
Orange.
Orange.
There you go. There you go.
And, what was their big? They had many hits. Tropical, something. I don't know. No, I can't remember. Anyway, so we made a deal with them, and they loved it and put it out. And the record did reasonably well. It went up to like number 15 on the dance charts. And that's when I think things were slipping in the disco land, and it just kind of faded away. But it's amazing. I still get an email on that. Where is Sean Benson? I don't know. I don't know where he is.
Well,
tell me he's in LA.
The voice is a treasure. And after I had listened to it probably 10 times, I mean, I realize it sounds a little extreme, but I do actually get stuck on things that I really like, and I must have played at least a dozen. Finally, I decided, who is Sean Benson? I Googled Sean Benson expecting to see a woman, a disco diva woman who just happened to spell her name Sean. It was a man. You could have picked my jaw up off the floor. I could not believe it.
So he is on the Internet. Good.
Yeah. If you Google him, it will bring up actually a record cover. And he's a very attractive black man. But John, my stars, I thought this guy was a disco diva. He sings beautifully, and I had no idea.
I know. And we can go on later, but I would have done more with him. But this is when AIDS was clicking in, too. And everybody was falling, and the company was losing money, blah, blah, blah. We'll get into that later if you want. But I would have definitely done a bunch more stuff with him.
Yeah, he had it. That guy has the talent just overflowing. It really blew me away. Well, let's go ahead, and for the listeners, we were talking about Sylvester and Don't Stop, so let's give them a flavor. This is a track that I used to play when I was DJing, and I remember the Megatone label turning round and round and round. Agnes, go ahead and run the Sylvester track, please, called Don't Stop. We'll be right back. And John, that song really does capture the essence of the energy that was the gay dance floor.
Oh, absolutely. When you played, I haven't played it in a while, I just picture that too, the excitement on the dance floor and the all those rises and stuff and there's people screaming and yelling and hands in the air and fans and all that stuff is something else, man. That was their biggest selling album, because that had Do You Want to Funk on it, on the album.
Yeah.
Patrick Kelly.
Well, now, Sylvester, did he record all of his music with Megatone?
No. First he started out Sylvester and the Hot Band, I believe that's what, Fantasy Records. He had a song called Friendship, I believe. It's kind of foggy with me. And this was with a small label, I think, a spinoff of Fantasy Records. And then most of his stuff, Dance Disco Heat, Mighty Real, that was at Fantasy. Then something happened there. And we were still working there, I know that, mixing a bunch of those, almost anything that Fantasy put out, even jazz records, we were mixing them. They were knocking things out left and right. And somehow he went with another company, Honey Productions, I think they were with, and Harvey Fuqua. They had a bad parting of the ways, I guess. And so Sylvester wasn't doing anything. And I remember my friend Marty Blackland, who was the founder of Megatone Records, and I went to our local club down in the Haight-Ashbury called the I-Beam. This phone's call interrupting. I hope it doesn't make any noise. I'm going to let it go through. And so we were down at the I-Beam, and here comes Sylvester and just walking in and hanging out and having a cocktail at the bar and talking. And I was working with Tip Warwick on a project that was not signed yet with Megatone yet. We were talking and working on some tracks. And Marty and I said, what are you doing? He goes, nothing. I have nothing going on. And so we hit him up. We go, well, we got these tracks. Why don't you come listen to them? We had an artist together, Gwen Jamay. She was going to sing. Do you remember her at all? Gwen, that's probably a little before your time. Anyways.
I guess I can't recall it.
Anyway, so we had her lined up to do the lead thing. I can't remember. She had one kind of good hit, and everything was going fine. I'll give you a little backstory on that, on Gwen Janae. So here we are. We're ready to do this, just ready to sign the contracts. But she had wanted this deal where she would have, on her cover of her album, that we'd have to pay for this dress, which was like $16,000 in back in that day, $60,000. That blew the deal. That blew the deal. we're going, oh, my God, if she wants this already, we can just imagine what's going to come in the future, you know. But like I say, Sylvester, he knew he was good, but he no ego. This guy was genuine. And so he says, yeah, I'll listen to it. And it took like a couple days. He goes, let's do it. You know, and he just finished doing with Patrick Colley, Do You Want to Funk? And I'm trying to think, was that later? I'm confused on the times, but we're all working at the same time and working for Sylvester to get him going, you know, because we thought this was a gold mine, you know, coming off You Might Think Me Almighty Real and all that, and the label let him go, you know. So we got him, which that was fantastic because that brought all the other artists aboard. The phones didn't ever stop, the demo tapes. They had, hundreds of them a day or a week anyways, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, in your meetings and in the time you spent with Sylvester, I have heard that he occasionally did drag and that he was absolutely stunningly beautiful. Did you ever see Sylvester do that?
Doing what now?
In drag. That he was absolutely
gorgeous.
Oh, yeah. That's
what he did, was drag. Yeah, he was a big drag queen. Oh, yeah, glitter, glitter, glitter. You know, I remember he was on Joan Rivers. Remember when she used to do the Tonight Show some years back? He was on, and Joan said something, well, what are you? You're a drag queen? And he goes, no, I'm Sylvester. There's only one of a kind. Yeah, he was a glitter queen, man. Major. He used to be with, his start was with the Cockettes. Does that ring a bell?
No, I'm afraid not. I wish it did.
They were, this is back in the hippie days in the 60s. It was a group of drug freaked out acid kids. that got together and made this group called the Cockettes and performed all over the United States. And he was kind of the standout. There, for your listeners, Google the Cockettes. There is a DVD on there on that whole period of the Cockettes. It's a great DVD. It was hit in the art world, theaters and stuff. Yeah,
I'm going to be Googling that myself.
Yeah, the Cockettes.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. Now, moving along back to Sean, how did you meet Sean Benson? What was the first encounter there? Because, as you know, I'm totally wowed by Sean Benson.
Yeah, like I said, he used to hang out at the disco, and he was a big fan of me and Marty Blackman and Barry Blum and all that. And in San Francisco, if you were in the business, you know, everybody knew everybody, you know. Kind of like any business, you know. And, he knew somebody, and he was brought to me by Mark, and we fell in love with him immediately, and the voice, it was just silky, you know, and it's kind of, we like that falsetto stuff, you know. And it was just wonderful, you know, and so we just hit it off. Like I said, we were friends until, God, and he just kind of disappeared off the planet. I know he's around. I heard that just a couple weeks ago, that he's around someplace. Maybe he's tuning in. Who knows? Tell him to call in.
I wish he would. But, yes, there is a website, and it does look like he's available for bookings. And I think so. So in any case, I'd love for the listeners to hear Seclusion. And, guys, this song just blew me away. As I said, I honestly have played it more times than I would be embarrassed to tell you today. And it caught me, yes, by complete surprise. It caught me by, and I swear to you, I thought it was a disco diva. And it turned, when I Googled him, turned out to be a man. Is this the only track he did?
Yes. In fact, we were working on something else, and that, like I said, things fell apart. And I'm not exactly sure what happened there. But I'm glad, because after we're done with the show, I'm going to Google him and call him. Because hopefully he's in. Did he say, is he in L.A. or anything? Or?
Well, let me put it like this. I was so stunned to see his picture that I hardly read a word on the site.
See how you are.
I was so
stunned. I'm the same way.
I thought it was a disco diva. And there he was, and I was just so stunned. And, oh, my stars. But, if you happen to come across Sean Benson, I would love to talk to him one day. What a remarkable. Well, folks,
I just want to tell you real quick, because I just remember Mark's last name, Watson. Watkins. Mark Watkins. That was the guy coming on to him. And who's the long gone to him, unfortunately.
I see. Good. We've lost so many.
We hyped this whole thing. I hope everybody likes it.
Oh, my. Yes, this track is called Seclusion by Sean Benson. Roll it, Agnes. And from the top of the hour, to remind you, the toll-free line, if you'd like to participate, is 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366. That's toll-free, 877-443-2366. Unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. It rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at Head On Radio Network, and you're welcome to participate in any way you like. John, wow. Just plain wow. You had to know that was huge when you first heard it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I got chills again just listening to it.
Me too. The guy has a way of just reaching out and grabbing you. And who wrote this? You were about to tell us, or you might have mentioned earlier, who wrote this? Who did the music? It's incredible. The combination of the music, the lyrics, and Sean is pure magic.
Mark Watkins wrote the lyrics. Barry Blum did the music, and Barry and I produced it. And in my studio, I had a studio in my house in San Francisco where we did a lot of the music in my little studio, with especially Joe Lowe, Joe Carroll, and all them in the studio. And Barry and I did knocked all kinds of hits, like, you know, with Fantasy, Right Spot, and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Fever. That was Fantasy again, Fever.
Yeah. Well, if it was done in your home, then the back of the music must be, for the most part, electronic, or did you have a drummer?
At first, the early Sylvester stuff, I was drummer, but like I said, Patrick Colley kind of came in and changed all that for us, you know. That's when the synthesizers were getting so cool that almost everything is that San Francisco sound, that electronic sound. And that's almost everything was synthesized. And we would bring in, you know, guitar players and stuff like that, or some percussion people. But for the most part, everything was done with synthesizers.
Well, Patrick Cowley was actually magical in that sense. You know, so many times with purely electronic tracks, it loses an emotional connection, but somehow Patrick was able to pass that through even electronically.
Yeah, because he loved doing the electronics, but he was a real believer in the talent, the singer, to bring out that, because that was the only really live thing, was the singer, to bring that, you know, gave it the soul, as it were, you know. So that was very, very, very important, you know. And he just died too young. I was just thinking, I was listening to, is it Rihanna or something? Somebody's doing I Feel Love in the background loop. I can't think what the song is right now. But and it's another song, but with Donna Summer, the loop, the rhythm loop going in the background. And he actually started what they call the mashups, which, you know, were popular a couple of years ago, of combining that stuff, you know, and what's it, Puff Daddy or whatever his name is now, Diddy, would do that, where they would take these rhythm tracks and loop them and do a whole new song on top of it, you know. And Patrick Cowley actually was the first one to do that, and he actually did it to I Feel Love, where he played, looped the bass section and played his synthesizer on top of that, like another song, all kind of dreamy, kind of spacey thing. 16 minutes long, I think.
Wow. Well, John, before we talk about more of the music, and there's so much more to get to, I'd like you to tell us a story about apparently you teamed up with a sound man named Bruce Tronston. Now, did you design? Did you design sound systems? Is that
no.
How that? What that?
No, but he was like the god of the disco on the West Coast of making. I remember they're called Sony Vega bass speakers. The whole thing with having the tweeters hanging in the air and all that, and to give you that really heavy bass, you know, to just knock you over, you know. Give you that buzz, you know, in the crowd. And he did pretty much all the major discos in San Francisco and all over the place, you know. He died too young, too, another guy. Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. Well, what was your partnership with him? The information I have here says that you teamed up with him. How did you work together?
Oh, he was my sound man at a place that, where was I working then? Oil Can Harry's. Downtown on Ellis Street in San Francisco, and worked there with the cowboy hat and all that stuff. He was my sound guy. He's the guy when we were talking earlier about the pitch turntables. This is before the Technique that's a brand for the listeners of Technique Turntables that every DJ still uses to this day if they're playing vinyl.
Sure.
He had in radio, have you been in radio?
Well, very, very early in my little lifetime, I remember Weathers turntables at an AM radio station in Tallahassee.
Do you remember the brand name RK? I think it was RKO or RK.
Well, let me tell you about that. In fact, I came across that information in an article I read today about you, and I actually don't know RKO. In fact, I Googled. I desperately tried to. I love technology and audio equipment, et cetera, and I desperately tried to find RKO turntables, but I couldn't find a word about them. And what fascinated me was that someone added a pitch control to your RKO turntables, and I was wondering, did they do that with like a variable voltage into the turntable? You can't just add a...
That was Bruce Tronson. That was Bruce Tronson. That's when I came back from 12 West, Jim Burgess, the DJ in New York City with Grace Jones and all that. I came back and I was like, I have to have this, you know, I didn't see what the make or the brand of the DJ. He did let me in the booth, but I was just overwhelmed. I don't remember what it was. So I came home and he got and made a variable pitch on the motor to do that.
That's beautiful.
It was lining up the beats, baby.
That's beautiful.
That really made me something in the area, you know, because nobody ever heard that. You know, I kind of brought it back to New York. New York gets credit for that, but I brought that back, and everything just went gung-ho for me then as a DJ, still producing and all that at the same time. And I won the Billboard DJ of the Year thing in 1976, first in the West Coast here, and that's what really got me into everything, Atlantic Records and Moby Dick Records and all them, you know.
Well, during the course of doing this show, I've talked to a number of people who are DJs, to various singers, and we always like to ask, because we never know what kind of story we're going to hear, we always want to ask about Grace Jones. Do you have any Grace Jones stories for us? Because we treasure them, because they're so, it's like the blind man and the elephant. It's like no two people ever tell anything similar to the other story about Grace Jones.
I bet you there's one thing in common. Quaaludes.
No.
I have a Grace Jones story. It was a really nice person. I met her in New York obviously I need a man and all that, and then later with all her other stuff. And we were dancing and all that stuff. So I got to know her, and when we had our gay pride in San Francisco, they would always bring in like a disco star to be, you know, the head of the parade or whatever. And it was Grace Jones. And so Grace Jones comes out, and Jerry, my lover, and I, go out to dinner at a friend's restaurant. She's totally flawed. She's always late, 2 hours late all the time. Totally flawed. And escargot, you know, you did the little stuff in there. She would dig in that with that little fork and fling it to all the customers in the restaurant.
So
embarrassing. So embarrassing. We got her off of that. But we got her up in the morning and got her on that float. I'm going to find a picture. There's a picture of, she's right in the middle. I'm with my co-DJ from Oil Canaries, and that's pretty funny, pretty funny.
That's the story.
Have you interviewed her? Is she around? I mean, she's around, but you don't hear nothing anymore.
No, I haven't heard a word about her except the various stories. She's legend. I've heard everything from a fight in a dressing room between a female artist that was in the show, had a fight with her, a physical shoving fight over something or another. Grace was, and I've forgotten the other story. You're, I think, the third Grace Jones story, but yours is by far the funniest. Oh, she did not flick her escargot at the custom.
She sure did.
Oh, my stars. And she's such a scary woman with those sharp features, you know, and I understand she's very tall, too.
Yeah, and what's amazing is the Maynard D and all that, you know, they let her go, because, you know, when she walked in the room, so everybody's watching us, you know, they didn't care. They were just laughing it up, you know. And we laughed and paid the bill, blah, 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 but, crazy. Crazy, crazy.
I think so. Tell us about Lisa. Now, Jump Shot is a huge anthem. Every gay man in America is no doubt danced to Jump Shot. If you haven't, you've missed something. And of course, used to play. Tell us about coming across Lisa and producing Jump Shot. That was a great song.
Yeah, Lisa, well, first off, when I first got into the business of producing, that's when I met up with Barry Blum. Actually, he had a little shy story on Barry Blum. He was a big rock and roller band and all this stuff, and he did not want to have his name associated with disco. So his stage name was Barry Bean. He's going to kill me for this, but it's true. I've talked to him about it. It was Barry Bean, and I bet he still kicks himself to this day that his real name is not on Jump Shout. Yeah, I think it's written by it. We both wrote that song. So I think it says Hedges Blum, and then but it says produced by John Hedges and Barry Blum. Barry Bean. So, but anyway, so while our first song, because I wanted to get into the producing myself, because like I said, Marty and I were kind of going. He was starting Megatone, and I'm going. I want to make records too, because we got educated at Fantasy Records, and meeting musicians and stuff, and you know how to do this stuff. So my first song was called "Show Me Yours, I'll Show You Mine" by a group called Corruption, which we did in a basement. Downtown in the Tenderloin, the worst part of town, with live musicians during the, laying down, I think it was, it could have been 8-track then. 8-track. I'm pretty sure it was. And laying the drums and then putting on the other stuff and the singers. I can't even remember who the singers were to come to think of it. Anyway, so that's how Barry and I got started with Show Me Yours, Show Me Mine, and I was able to sell that record in 24 hours. To Prime Cut Records or something out of New York. So that really got us going. Now we're going to be big stars and make the music. That's when Barry and I decided we could write, and he was he knew that I was really getting famous in the local press and stuff. And so we sat down and wrote a record, Jump Shout. And my idea was, we'll get this played in the clubs. We start dropping names, Jump Up, Studio One, Tick Tock Goes the Clock, everybody's at the truck. We dropped all the major clubs,
And so,
Yeah. So we needed a singer, and he said, I have this girl who was a punker. This is during the punk rock, just starting. Lisa, an artist, a painter, a really good painter, still to this day. I think she does painting on for big corporations like on underwear, women's stuff, really big time. And anyway, so he said we should try her out, and we did at this studio, and we loved her, and she was another one. I don't know what's going on. Why am I doing this? I'm not a disco queen. In fact, it was anti-disco during the, the punk rock people, And boy, that song just took off, unbelievable. It went number one.
I remember both dancing to it and playing it there. The song brought about it when it played. The song there was such a feeling on the dance floor of connection to all the other gay folk on the planet, because the major clubs were, and you even got some of the names in that were even New York clubs, weren't they? And there were, there was the Badlands was mentioned.
Everybody. Everybody.
It was a roll call. It was a major roll call of all the major hot spots and the major club of the day. And there seemed to be such a connection, because in your mind you just knew that song was playing at the other club and the other club and the other club. But in your mind you would imagine that you were all dancing to it together. As gay people, that feeling of community is like really something that lights us up, because it's not a feeling that we know that well, being separate.
Yeah, I remember we did the song, and it was done, and I could not sell that song for the life of me. I had a big ego trip for the first song. Oh, we're going to sell this. I just know it's a hit. I could not get that song played anywhere. And so I finally got, I can't remember who it was, somebody at the Trocadero Transfer put the doggone song on, and of course the crowd went absolutely berserk. And that's when I met Bill Motley from Moby Dick Records. That's the label Lisa's on. And he went nuts, because I wanted to take this, and he wanted to remix. And I go, yeah, well, what the heck? I put it out on Hot Tracks. That was a DJ service kind of thing.
Yeah. We played some of the,
It was their first song, cut one of their first issue. So that helped a lot. And then that's where I think he kind of heard it, and then in the Trocadero that really did it for him. And he went and did the remix. And with all those rises and stuff, and from the minute that came out. I mean, it was, everybody played it. We had no problem getting that record played. And to this day, people keep writing me about Sylvester and Lisa Jump Shot. And she was so big in Mexico. If you Google her on a YouTube thing, go Lisa Mexico, you'll see she's like a major rock star in Mexico. I mean, like major. They're singing every word of all places.
No,
but
amazing.
So Lisa's really good, and now we, you know, she's good, you know, the fame. She loved getting all those gigs, going all over the world, you know, singing Jump Shout, and that's when we did the album with Moby Dick with, and she had another pretty good size, not as big as Jump Shout, but Rocket to Your Heart, and that was another nonstop album, which we kind of were getting famous for, because Fever was all three tracks on one side, all blended together, and then the other side, and also the Lisa album, side one was all tracked together, too, you know, already segued, you know, so that was kind of cool.
Well, I have to say that, Jump Shot is as close to a dance floor anthem, national anthem for the dancers as anything I have ever heard. It's a wonderful song, and you just don't get tired of it. It's just a wonderful, wonderful track.
Yeah, I'd like to redo that. Redo it again with new clubs, you know.
Yeah, with the new club name. Yeah, the club names you're going to hear are, some of them are still rolling along, some are not, but I'm about to tell you, in the day, it was the national anthem. Agnes, would you run that track for us? It's by Lisa, and it's Glenn Rivera's edit of Jump Shout. Got to tell you, that lights me up. Stuff like that, I don't want to stop hearing the music. I just want to mix into the next one. What a wonderful, wonderful And I've got to tell you, there's probably not a gay man on the planet that doesn't have a warm fuzzy for that particular song.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one. That was a good one. That was no radio play, but so is gazillions, you know?
Yeah, back in the day. So you have a beagle. Is that what the beagle saying hello?
Did he just bark?
Yeah, he said hello to us. What is his name?
His name is Frankie. Frankie and Johnny.
Frankie and Johnny. Too funny. You know, our friend Glenn has a couple of dogs named Disco and Boogie.
Cool.
I think it's just priceless. I can't resist telling that story. You were talking about the group called Corruption that you actually used live instruments on with the track So Show Me Yours. What is that story? You did tell us about Corruption. You said it sold quickly, I think.
Yes. What happened was, like I say, my brilliant partner, Barry Blum, musician, speak, and I wanted to record, and just find anybody that had a recorder just so we could lay the tracks on, demo at least, to get it in, to go in and then redo the thing in another studio. Well, it turned out, so he had this A-track, and he's really brilliant on this technology thing with, you know, cables and all this. So we were in this basement thing, like I said, in the Tenderloin, and where bands would rehearse. So we would ran cables off the main room where we were all the way to another room and closed it off and put what they call a click track, you know, just going click, click, click to get the beat. And the drummer would play along with the click, and then we'd add the bass and so on and add the rest of the instruments and then bring the singers in. Did that whole thing literally on A-track, bouncing back and forth to other tracks and coming out with a thing, and I did not go into the studio and redo that. It was just the first one, and everybody liked it, you know. It really did. It was not a big hit at all, but it certainly was the first commercial song that I produced with Barry that got out there, you know.
Do you think that this one crossed over at all?
Which one? Jump Shout?
Show Me Yours.
No. Did not cross over. No, it was just, nothing. It's kind of just played. It wasn't, didn't hit the charts or nothing yet. It was played, but everybody brings it up to me, so like somebody must have been playing it. I don't even have a copy of it. Yeah.
Actually, well, our friend Glenn Rivera does. I'm sure he'd be glad to shoot one to you. Before we talk about some more of your tracks, we have a caller that would like to talk with you, and it is none other than the world-famous Mr. Bobby Vittoretti. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. It's Bobby.
Hi, Bobby.
Oh, my God. It's been like 25 years.
I know. And I remember remember the party. And I was out of town and couldn't make it for that party. But Bobby Vittoretti, talk about Trocadero Transfer. I was just saying. That's where Jump Shot. Was it you that played it?
Yes, it was.
I thought so. I wasn't sure. I didn't want to say, but I thought, yeah.
Oh, that was a great party. Remember the party? What is that? That was a record pool party, wasn't it?
No. Remember the party was with those bear guys, and they brought back.
Oh, remember the party? Yeah. No, I didn't play it. No.
I think when you went Jump Shot, we were playing earlier. I think I brought it into you, and you played it when you worked at the Trocadero, and that's how I got together with Bill Molly.
The old days. I want the crowd to know, when I moved to San Francisco in 78 from Fort Lauderdale, John was one of the first friends I made, you know, and, I remember meeting him at the record pool, and where were you? Were you working up by Broadway, right?
I was, and then I was working at Oil Can Harry's, and then you guys, you didn't open the Trocadero, you came in after, right?
Yeah, I came in after Gary Tye.
Because I remember I was working at Oil Can Harry's, and then at Super Disco, the Trocadero opened up and killed us. not right away, because I don't know if you remember, Bobby, when they first opened, it was a membership club, and in San Francisco, you don't do membership clubs. And nobody would go. You know, I'm going, Jesus, this place is fantastic.
You know, I was listening to Jump Shout before, and my remixes, of course, the only thing I ever used was a razor blade. So what I did with that song, I would do, At the truck, at the pro, wherever I play, whenever I do a guest spot, I do another remix. So when I
heard that.
I play Studio One. You know,
I got feedback from all the guys when you did that. It's a small town, man.
My my
Bobby,
race
I just got to ask you, are you in New York?
Yeah, I live in Manhattan now. I'm living in Chelsea.
And are you still music doing DJing or anything?
I'm back in it.
All right.
It's about a year and a half now. I've resurfaced.
Well, that's good. That's great, because you certainly changed everything. You're one of the biggest, brightest DJ stars, especially from the West Coast, that's for sure.
Well, you know. Thanks a lot. Well, anyway, I just thought I'd give you, say hello, and when I'm in Palm Springs.
Yeah, you got to look me up. I'm in the book. I keep my number listed. Anybody can call me. Bobby, you did a production with the song Tommy James and Shonda, I Think We're Alone Now or something?
Oh, yeah, Scott Allen.
Yeah, I remember you doing that, yeah.
I did that, and I did Lady of the Night.
Lady of the Night, yeah.
He's doing something new now, Ray Martinez. He just called me on the phone. He did, Amont, If There's Love, and Hazy Shades.
Yeah.
You see, I'm waiting for him to send me a demo of it. But you got to see the new equipment I bought. I just bought it the other day. I bought this new sound, new mixing board called the Torq Exponent.
Oh boy!
You know, you mix with your MP3s.
Right.
Have you seen these units yet?
No, I haven't.
Well, they're fun to have around the house, you know.
Yeah.
you can figure out how to use it.
Yeah, I hear you, I play at this club called Mixie's Boy Bar in Palm Springs, like just for events and stuff, you know. And everything is high-tech, mixing the MP3s and the music videos by beat, you know, the whole thing, you know. And I'm having fun with that. Still staying. I can't believe I'm still doing this all these years. I have not stopped working since 1971 someplace.
Oh, my God.
I know.
How's
I can't
hearing?
Believe I'm alive.
How's your hearing?
Pardon? I had a hearing test, and my hearing is pretty much normal.
That goes through.
I can't hear him. Yeah, my lover says you never listen to me. Get your ears fixed. But I did, and I did go because of what he was saying, because I kept going, what? And he goes, it's that disco stuff, you know. And I went and had my ears tested, and they came out all right. So I'm fine. He says, okay, you're blanking me out.
Well, I just saw Rob. I was just speaking with Robbie Leslie. I saw him recently.
And go ahead.
He's still using the same headphone I turned him on to when he was at the poop deck. That was in 1976, 86, 96, where we were 100. That's 30 years now. He's got the same Sennheiser.
Oh, my God. Well, hopefully he puts new pads on it, because that'd be pretty
close.
Yeah,
he put new pads on it. How about you? Using the same headphone?
No, I use some Sony headphones. Pretty much, that's it, you know.
Yeah,
but oh God, it's so good to hear your voice, because I wanted to see you, and I just couldn't get to that party. And I get feedback here and there from Steve Fabius,
yeah.
And I see him and stuff. And when I moved to Palm Springs, Steve and his friends took my entire, because I didn't want to bring my record collection, because it's God forbidden so hot down here. So I gave it all away, and Steve and his friends took all my records. All of them. And a lot of it's stuff to unopen and stuff, so they're in good hands.
No kidding, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, it's so nice to have everything on my hard drive, you know? I have my whole record collection on it. So
Me too. I am with that. Do you have a website I can see where you're at and stuff?
Yeah, BobbyVitteritti.com.
Oh, God says when I get off the phone. We were talking earlier. Were you tuned in when we were talking about Sean Benson?
No, I wasn't. I just got on. I got on when you were talking about Jump Shout.
Yeah, because Pete was telling me that he did not know this song, and I was saying, he used to hang out and dance to your music all the time.
Oh, really?
In the Trocadero. He's always in the middle. Sean Benson doing Seclusion, and that's where we discovered him. But then he disappeared.
A lot of people came out in Trocadero, you know?
Oh, yeah. I bet you got a Grace Jones story.
What? What kind of story?
Peter was saying every DJ has a Grace Jones story, which I had one, but I performed at your place many times. Did she screw up on Quaaludes or anything?
Oh, you mean a drug story?
Anything funny?
Sure, Bobby, go ahead and tell us. We're doing some Grace Jones stories this evening. He had a great one.
Oh, about the Grace Jones? You mean What are you talking about? Goofing around with the entertainers?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, just a memory.
Go ahead, Peter. You tell him, Peter.
I was explaining it to John that many of the artists and the DJs, when they come in the show, I will ask them if they have a story about Grace Jones, because stories about Grace Jones are like the three blind men and the elephant.
Story, what do you?
There you go. I knew you would. So we're doing Grace Jones stories this evening, if you have one.
Oh, honey, well, her first show, when she came out with Sending the Clowns, they sent her down to Fort Lauderdale, the Marlin Beach Hotel. That was the first stop. And Island Records gave her, I don't know, so much money, like maybe $300 cash. You're just spending money, your petty cash money to go, you know. But she spent it all on hustlers and drugs and everything, you know. And she ended up staying over my house for the rest of the night. she didn't have money for the hotel. So we brought her out to the Copa, and I'll never forget her on the dance floor. They went ahead and called ahead and said, Grace Jones is coming to the Copa, quick. So whoever was playing, I think it was Bill Kelly, or he put on I Need a Man and played the introduction. Dun 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 dun, and played it again and then again. And we're all dancing around in a circle, and she had a cape on. She dropped it on the floor, and everyone's dancing, clapping their hands, and the strobe light's going on, and he's repeating the intro again and again, and Grace Jones is there. Da, 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 da. Finally, she bent over, she picked up the robe, she said, let's get the fuck out of this place, you know? And she just picked it up, threw it over her shoulder, and walked right out.
No.
We dropped her off at a bookstore.
Oh, my stars. Oh, no.
Is that a terrible thing?
When did you see her after you dropped her off at the bookstore, Bobby?
Well, she came trolloping home.
Oh, my stars. Oh, well, you know, the Grace Jones stories, I just never know what I'm going to hear. And I just can't remember
what.
That was a great story. And John's story, she had one of those little tiny forks you used to eat escargot, and she was flicking the content. She was scooping out little bits of the stuffing and flipping it onto the other guests, the other patrons of a restaurant that they were at. But apparently she was on Quaaludes pretty heavy that night.
God, Bobby, it's so
she also, we were at a stoplight, she spilled a bottle of poppers. That's when poppers were real big. They came out with that new brand. What was it called? Pig poppers? You remember those?
Yeah. No.
It was Rush poppers, but then a new brand came out called Pig, and Mike Wilkinson Mike Wilkinson from Disco Net. He was behind them. He was pushing these poppers. Pig poppers. He brought down a whole case of them. So anyway, we had a bottle of poppers. The only one at the stoplight, she passed them to me in my brand new Mazda, and she built the damn thing on my on the passenger seat. The son of a bitch.
My stars. There's just a lot of Grace Jones stories out there, and I have learned that that is always a good question to ask. You just never know what you're going to hear. Whatever happened to her? John was asking that, too. She seems to have vanished.
She just did a commercial in France for a French car. What is that French car? Is it Saab? No, Renault. The Renault commercial.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, anyway, listen, I'm going to let the show go on. I hope
thank you for calling.
I'm good hearing your voice, Bobby. You sound exactly the same. That accent, that New York guy. That New York guy that was in San Francisco and took over the town.
All right,
you,
John,
Bobby.
You take care of yourself.
All right, buddy.
Good evening, Peter.
And Peter, thank you. You know what I mean.
Yes, sir. Hugs to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's our friend, Bobby Vittorini. John, Bobby is one of a number of DJs who we have a segment when we have shows without a guest. We call it a Just Us show. And we do news and events and politics, gay politics and marriage and all the things that we normally talk about. But the last half hour of the show we call the gay bar across the street. And sometimes we call it the Paradise Dance Hall. And we have various DJs who mix sets for that, and we'll say so-and-so is playing at the... Anyway, Bobby is one of the DJs at the gay bar across the street, and we often run his mix sets between 10:30 and 11. We have, of course, Bobby and Jerry Bonham and Victor in New York, VJC. He's Disco 935 and Larry Sanders. And the list goes on and on. I'm leaving out a lot of people. We have from Miami, Hank Steinauer. So in any case, if you ever do any mix sets, we would love to have you at the gay bar across the street some evening.
Oh, I'll let you know on that.
Okay. You know, I want to tell you about this, a little story about this song, Right Spot, by Blueprint. This has been several years ago. I was in touch with a lot of music people over some dance CDs, and people began contacting me. Do you know how it goes? People call, like, do you know where I can get this song? And sometimes they will have a few words or a few lyrics, or sometimes they will know who it's by, or they can't, you know, people remember this music and want to hear it so badly that it just amazes me, the number of people who still want to. But in any case, a fellow from Hawaii emailed me and was looking for a track called Right Spot by Blueprint. And at the time, I could not place it. And when I saw it in the list today, I was so excited. I thought, I remembered it from a couple of years ago. He really wanted to hear it. It was a club he used to go to that used to play it. But bedarn if his email address is bouncing back, so I can't tell him. He must have changed his email address. But apparently the track Right Spot really stuck in someone's mind. What is the story on Right Spot?
Well, I'm going to blow the bubble here. I had nothing to do with Right Spot. I got some dirt on it. That's Barry Blum. That's the Barry Blum is Blueprint. And he is a singer, and what happened was, while I was doing stuff with Fantasy and Megatone, or no, with Megatone Records, I had left Fantasy, and Barry and I were working on other stuff, and he decided to go without me, and I didn't even know he did this song, and he went to the label, pretty much behind my back, Top Secret and all that, and did this for Fantasy Records, and of course, you know, I got really ticked off about it, you know, because it's a great song, and I played it and stuff, all that, and it's a killer song. But honestly, I had nothing to do with that song, not even promotion.
That's a funny story. Glenn included it in our track list, and so it's interesting that he included that, because I indeed know someone who would love to have a copy of that. But I tell you what, before we go into any of the other tracks, we have another caller, none other than the most beautiful woman in the entire planet, Miss Cynthia Manley, is on the line for you.
Oh,
welcome to the show.
Hey,
Cynthia,
how
welcome.
You guys doing?
Hi, sweetheart. It's good that you called.
Cynthia. Mr. John Hedges himself. I had to call in and say, hey, dude, what's up?
Hi, honey. Now, I see Cynthia all the time.
You're going to see me again. I'm doing a breast cancer benefit fundraiser thing. At Mixie's in Palm Springs on the 28th. So come on by and say hey. Have a
July
day
or June? Day. I'm sorry, what was it? Is it July or June?
June 28th.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I'll definitely come by.
Cool. So what are you guys up to? You solving all the problems of the world and getting down to the deepest, darkest secrets of disco?
Yeah,
well,
Cynthia. Yeah, we're just talking, you know, and obviously, you know, Cynthia Manley is a Blaisdell gang, the mega star of Moby Dick Records, that's for sure. And those were the days, and Cynthia's still cute as a button, everybody.
Oh,
and
thanks.
You do, you look fantastic. I saw you a couple months ago at Mixie's, and
you
looking
right
great.
Yeah, right before I left for Brazil the last time. It was great.
That's right.
It was a fun night.
Yeah, Cynthia gets all over the place, you know. And, that's great. I can't wait. So are you doing a band thing, or are you going to, what
no,
are you doing?
No, she wants the disco hits. So I'm going to do a couple of the songs I wrote in Italy and, of course, the Boys Town Gang stuff. And
oh, I can't wait.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
I'm looking forward to it. I love that new bar. What a great location, huh?
I know. That's what we're talking about. It's right in the main drag on Palm Canyon. Mixie's Boy Bar upstairs.
In the heart of the city.
Yes. Do you remember, were you listening when Bobby Bedaretti was on? Do you remember
who
he
was? No, I was not.
Do you remember who he is? He was the top DJ at the Trocadero Transfer.
You know what? I did so many drugs back then, honey. All the DJs were my very best friends. But
okay, well, then never mind. Well, at least you remember my name.
That's right, John. I remember the important people.
I love it.
No, I don't remember Bobby, but I'm sorry to say that. I probably would if I knew his face, and he probably
still Yeah. He was like the top DJ. In fact, he won the national DJ in San Francisco and kind of exploded the big club scene in San Francisco. He's pretty well known around the world for breaking, you know, pretty famous guy. He is famous.
Right. Well, now I feel like a geek. So sorry, Bobby.
Yeah,
honored to have you, brother.
So that's great. That's great. I'm so glad you called in because we're just having fun auditioning about everybody and talking about Sylvester, of course. You know, everyone wants to hear all the dirt and all that and playing some of my tunes, and it's kind of fun.
Well, you would have, if anybody's got dirt on Mr. Sylvester, it would be you, wouldn't it, love?
Yes, yes.
So one of the things we've been doing this evening is telling Grace Jones stories. I remember clearly the Grace Jones story that you told when you were on the show a while back. I think you had a shoving match in a dressing room. Wasn't that you?
Yes, that was me. Ms. Jones had slipped into my dressing room to do a line, and when I came in, she was a little bit huffy about why I came into her dressing room, and I said, obviously you can't read, and you know, cause my name was very clearly on the door, and she stood up to her all 7 feet of her with her platforms on, and yeah, it was a diva moment. I actually, you know, I had fun and got along with most people, but Ms. Jones and I just didn't see eye to eye.
Well, Cynthia, I have to tell you, your story about Grace Jones was the first Grace Jones story that we had on the show, and I have learned from that conversation with you that evening to always ask people if they have a Grace Jones story because they never cease to amaze. Bobby just told us one. John has one. Each is more outrageous than the one before it. So thank you. You started that tradition, actually.
She's a scary girl. I mean, I'm sure like all of us, she's probably a wiser, more gracious woman now, but at the time, she was scary. But
yeah.
I happen to be a feisty little 5'2" thing, so I don't back down easy, and especially my hip was bigger than hers at the time, so, you know, I was a little bit full of myself. And she didn't scare me. So, yeah, we had a bit of a little match. She ended up on her ass, and I was ended up doing her drugs, so it was all good.
Oh, my star. So, Cynthia, you are indeed back from Brazil. We were going to have you back on the show when you finished Brazil. Are you done with Brazil now?
Yeah, why don't I get off and let you guys get back to John, and I would love to hook up another time and tell you all about it and tell you I've got a bunch of stuff going. But let's stick with John. He's the star of the show tonight, and let me hook up with you guys another time.
Absolutely. We'll coordinate it through our friend, the executive director of talent booking, Mr. Glenn Rivera. So we'll set it up soon.
That's right, Buddy Glenn, and the guy is just an amazing resource, isn't he? He's not only
a person,
but he loves disco music, and he's just a real supporter of the art form in every way you can imagine. He's just an amazing guy, and I'm proud to have him as a friend. He'll be at the show out in Palm Springs, John. So,
I can't wait to see you. Yeah, I love you, honey, and I'll definitely be there for you.
All right, John. I love you too, brother, and it was nice talking to you guys, and thank you, Peter, for your wonderful show and for keeping this great music alive and the people that helped make it fabulous, keeping us in the loop. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Okay.
Thank you for calling. Good night to you.
Bye.
Of course,
I'll talk to you soon, and we'll do another show.
Absolutely.
Bye.
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 I love her.
Yeah, yes, it was a surprise. She was, I believe she was on the show. Oh, shortly. The show's about a year old, and she was on, I think, the second month of the show, and she wowed the crowd. She's got some incredible, absolutely incredible stories. I'm so glad.
I'm just thrilled that she's going to be doing some of these songs because I haven't heard her do these in years because she got into a band thing where she was doing, I think jazz and stuff. Nice things that got good reviews and all that, but this is going to be very exciting. I can't wait. And I'm sure Mixie's going crazy thinking of that. So that's going to be great. That's like coming up soon, a couple weeks.
Well, I know that's something you're looking forward to. Now, Cynthia's in California, but you're in Arizona, so you're good.
I'm in Palm Springs, California.
Somehow I got the impression earlier that you're in Arizona. I always just thought, I guess I put the heat together, the dry heat. You're California, too. Though.
Yes, Palm Springs, California guy.
Well, tell us about Jolo.
Jolo, that's Joe Carroll and Lauren Carter. They started out as Jolo, but these two girls, especially Joe Carroll and Jolo, Lauren, did backup on just about every Megatone record out there, period. Especially Joe Carroll. She was like the a vocal arranger. So we brought Joe in for everything, to vocal arrange for the backups or even the leads to help out. I mean, she was just had a God-given talent for doing that. And we just fell in love with Joe Carroll. I mean, we were a best of friends. You know, she's not with us either. Do you want to hear the story on this?
Yes, please.
We would still work together. In fact, my last production I did was a Christmas album, a charity album called Carols Across America. I think it was about 3 years, 4 years ago. And she has a couple Christmas songs on her. Anyway, so we did that. And we always worked together. We're best friends, you know, and all this. And then she wanted to switch up her life because her roots were originally in cabaret. A cabaret singer and doing shows and productions and stuff like that. So she was doing this contest in San Francisco to become the cabaret winner of the year or whatever. And everything was just moving in her direction, getting press and the paper and all this stuff. And then the final night was coming up, and we're all getting ready to go there. And she was all dressed up and had just coming out of her hairdresser's house and touched her doorknob and had a brain aneurysm and dropped dead. Just like that.
Oh, my.
Almost the peak of a new career, and I went to see her at the hospital, and it's on the ventilator, you know, because it keeps you alive, to harvest your organs. But she was fantastic. What a way to go. She was made up with a hairdresser, the makeup and everything, ready to go. She's laying there. What a way to go. But I miss her terribly. That's about 3 years now already. But, she was definitely one of the big things at Megatone. Could not live without her, period. And I think anybody you would talk to behind the scenes has a Joe Carroll story how wonderful and talented she was, period.
So after a period of time of doing the backup vocals, she did the track Last Call with on Megatone?
We were, that was a Megatone, right? That's when we had the studio in the house, Barry and I, at my house. And they wrote that song and arranged, and we brought Barry in because Barry had was like Thatcher Colley 10 times with the electronic synthesizing equipment, and we recorded all those tracks to Last Call in my house, and then took it over to that one studio I was talking about earlier, the Automat, and had it mixed and put that out, and that record was zooming up the charts. Then something terrible happened. Marty Blackman's was on Megatone at the time. I still wasn't on board as an owner, but I was a producer because I worked for many labels at the time. And they were donating a Patrick Colley Greatest Hits thing to the Gay Men's Health Center in New York City or something. Part of the proceeds are going or something. And a disgruntled employee turned in the company to somebody, the FBI or whatever, saying that they were commingling funds, which he didn't know at the time. You have to put it in a different escrow kind of whatever. So the cops came into the company and handcuffed Marty and took him away for embezzling funds from a charity. So what happened... After that record was climbed up, I think, to number 17. It was zooming. Everybody was playing because Last Call, everybody played it at the end of the night. And we got a terrible backlash that we were ripping off a charity, but Megatone was, not me. Megatone Records was. All the DJs dropped all our records overnight. Nobody was playing. And just stopped. And it took forever for us to get back on track, which we did eventually. But it just shows you how shit can happen. Excuse me. Crap can happen. And that's what happened, and that record just hung there. But it still hangs on to this day. People talk about that record.
Well,
I still hear it in there.
in the day there was no internet to clear up rumors and stories like this. It was a slow boat for everyone to find out what the truth about things. So it was very slow.
Right. Well, what also is nice about the internet today is, like, you can go and get Last Call by Jolo, and there's a YouTube video of it.
I'd love to run Last Call for listeners. Before we do, though, we have an email that's arrived for you. It's from Ernest Cole. And Ernest Cole, the man himself, and what a delightful fellow he is. He says, John, how are you? And he says, Peter, I hope you're dandy. He says, I just want to thank you. He's speaking to you, John. I just want to thank you for all the wonderful memories and times and hits of my Megatone years. I have a surprise. Just today, all of our old hits, like Hold On to Life, Can We Try Again, and Dance Right Back into Heaven, are available on iTunes. He says, John, I thank you, and I send you love, with plenty of X's and O's. So that's from our friend Ernest Cole. I wanted to share that with you.
Ernest did a great record on that charity album I was talking to you about called Happy New Year. very, very good, and people still play that to every New Year. Yeah. I love you, Ernest, if you're listening.
So let's run the Jolo track. And when was this done in relation to her untimely death? Was this
this was done way we were peaking at Megatone Records at the time. Ernest was with the label then too. I don't even know, 81, 82, 83. That's a good question. I don't know. Then she just died, like I said, 3 years ago. This is in 2001 maybe. When she started. But we, like I said, we worked on that album right before she died. So I had her last commercial success, and another guy put out something. But this one, she'll live forever. You know, Christmas songs live forever. So, Carols of North America. I wish those were available on the net. You know, I had to take them down. Here's another side story before you play it. When you do, like, Christmas songs that are written by somebody else, right? Usually, you know, Christmas and all that.
Sure.
You have to pay royalties on those. So I had it up on a website and iTunes and all that, but I kept getting billed for it to play, you know, to keep that on the internet, because people, every time you play it, you have to pay. So it was a charity, for God's sakes, you know. So I had to take it all down. So I don't think you could find those songs anywhere, Carols Across America. I don't think. I haven't Googled it in a while, but
that's
yeah.
A shame. It would seem that songs that are so important and are so many years old would eventually move into the public domain, but apparently
they
never.
They changed that little business dirt because the Disney studios were going to lose a lot of their early songs from Snow White and all those days to public domain, and Congress changed it and backdated everything to a lot of those songs, so they're not in public domain anymore. Which
so we have,
if the family is supposed to get part of that money, they should. Yeah, we're fine. Anyways, last call.
Yeah, last call. Let's run this. This is a Jolo track, and it is on Megatone, and it's edited by Glenn Rivera. Last call. I can spoil it.
Lights are low. I'm feeling high. Looking for that special guy. I've got one more chance for true romance. If my love comes, I've been watching and waiting, and I've got my eye on you. Too much time is wasting. We've got better things to do.
We're
gonna dance.
and what memories that brings back, and especially for you. I think you were close.
Yes, yes, very much. I got a little teary-eyed there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you going to do? Life goes on.
A special, special lady. And,
very.
And we, none of us know the minutes of the days that we have ahead of us, and it's a great thing that you know the story you told that she was you know she was at her she was ready to do something creative and she was happy and
yes she was. I got to tell you, you know, JoLo are the Patrick Collie singers. Did you know that? Joe Carroll and Lauren Carter they sang all the vocals on the Patrick Collie albums.
I had no idea.
Megatron Man, all that.
That was they, as they say it. That's amazing. I did not know.
Yeah.
But it's ironic. It wasn't intentional that we played Last Call last. We are running near the end of the show. And, John, I have to tell you, you have been a most remarkable guest. I've enjoyed every minute of this.
Well, thank you so much. I wish we had more time. I'm really getting off on it myself, especially got people calling in. And sometime next day we'll do it again. Like, we'll talk about Fever. I got stories about them and all that stuff. And a radio guy who's played the record and how he got murdered. And I got some good stuff.
Wow. Yeah, I'd love
to. For the next show, huh?
I would love, yeah, that's a preview, kids. That's the preview for the next season of John Hedges and Strictly. Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to have you back, and I certainly appreciate Glenn setting you up to be on the show. Just remarkable stories and a remarkable career, and indeed we all owe you a debt of gratitude for the wonderful music and what you've done. It's been a great ride.
It's been a great ride, and I enjoyed doing it, and I still enjoy doing it. And like I say, Peter, thank you so much, and let's do it again real soon.
Let's do it. And our best to Jerry, the man who loves the music.
Yeah, he's in the other room now. He's sweating out there. He's going in the pool because I won't want to play his disco music because we're on the
phone. Oh, my stars. He's probably angry at me. Maybe we could have him. Maybe we could hear from Jerry a little bit on the next time around. We'll get the other side of the story. Okay.
Thank you, Peter.
So good night to you. Yes, sir. Good night to you, John.
Bye-bye.
Wow. Good evening. And what a wonderful guest that was. Glenn never ceases to amaze me with the folks that he brings to the show. And as Cynthia Manley said, and John, too, Glenn works tirelessly to set up these wonderful people. And each one has been a treasure in themselves, a treasure. And you just never know what you're going to hear from them, which is makes my life exciting, and I trust yours also. So we are pushing toward the end of the hour. I need to tell you that there is, in fact, a horn section this evening, myself and Mr. John Fox, and a secret horn participant will be joining us. And John Fox will also have a live show at midnight Eastern time. So there's a couple more hours of live programming on the Head On Radio Network. It is certainly not over. Thank you for joining us.